zoning code. The property is located on the north side of Lewis Georgetown Highway. The 911 address is 22975 Lewis Georgetown Highway in Georgetown. The zoning district is C1. The tax parcel is District 135, MAP 16, parcel 12. We have zero letters of support, zero letters of opposition, and one mail return.
Good evening.
There are no letters on the floor.
We've done that in the past, that's fine. One thing might be helpful, though, just so that we don't forget, is if we have those witnesses sworn in now, so that when they come up, we don't forget to do that.
Yes. I also have some additional exhibits to hand out.
If you would, please hit your microphone as well.
I'm sorry.
There we go.
Oh, that's better. Okay.
I would have two witnesses that I would need sworn this evening. First is Andrew Peterson. He's a licensed engineer with the state of Georgia.
If you would hit your mic again, please. There you go.
Peterson, can you state your name and address for the record?
Sure. Andrew Peterson. Last name is Peterson, Box 165, Fairview Village, Pennsylvania.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Nardi, did I get that right?
Yes, my name is Jacob Minardi, state licensed PE in Delaware. I'm with Network Connects, and my office address is 5000 Atrium Way, Suite 3, Mount Laurel, New Jersey, 08054.
And do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Hello, testing?
Okay. It'll stay on, so.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Hello? Yes, perfect. Perfect. Again, by way of background, this application has been submitted as a special use exception. This is a use that's permitted within the C1 district, provided we meet the requirements set forth in the county code at section 115-194.2, which with these witnesses, I would purport that we would meet those requirements. An application was filed on behalf of Tower North Development, LLC. The anchor tenant for this project is a company called New Singular Wireless PCS, LLC, better known as AT&T Mobility. And the first witness I would typically call would be Mr. Peterson, the radio frequency engineer. Mr. Peterson would testify regarding details of the need and also the particular property that was selected for this particular cell site. And marked as applicant's exhibit A2 is an aerial view of the subject property. And the property, as stated, is located within the C1 commercial district. It's located along Lewis Georgetown Highway, having an address of 22975 Lewis Georgetown Highway. And it is also identified as parcel number 135-1612. The property sits kind of between two commercial uses. Fairly intensive commercial uses. One is a plumbing HVAC company on the left-hand side of the property, and the other is AP Crowell and Sons, which is a site contracting street paving company on the right-hand side of the property. And immediately behind, at the rear of the property, is a fairly dense wooded area with mature tree growth. And of course, the road itself is a fairly busy, well-traveled road, otherwise known as Route 9. Mr. Peterson would further testify that the applicant has a lease agreement with the underlying property owner, and marked as applicant's exhibit A3 is a deed for the underlying property owner, which is the Ernest E. McGee Jr. Irrevocable Trust, which is the owner of the property. And ultimately, the tower company, which is the applicant here tonight, Tower North Development, LLC, has signed a lease agreement with the property owner, and that's marked as applicant's exhibit A4. And that is attached or signed by all the parties. And is in full force and effect, and it allows Tower North to move forward with this application, present the application before the board this evening, and ultimately move forward should the board see fit to grant the application to actually build and construct the tower. Mr. Peterson would then talk about other sites that were considered, because that's one of the requirements under the county code, and marked as applicants. A5 is a document that was prepared by Brian Glivick, who is the Director of Strategic Site Development for Tower North for the applicant, which details the properties that he considered. The first three properties that are listed here were properties near the subject property, but he was not able to come to terms with the underlying property owners. For those respective properties. There was, within a two-mile search ring of this site, one existing tower, which is a Verizon wireless tower, which is located at 24009 Springfield Road in Georgetown. In fact, I think Mr. Peterson had worked on that application when Verizon was here making presentation. But that was a tower that was approved at 134 feet. That's fairly far south. It's about 1.8 miles south of this proposed location, and is an area of coverage that AT&T presently has. So Mr. Peterson ultimately concluded that site would not work for co-location for AT&T's antennas. And that conclusion is set forth in Mr. Peterson's letter of August 26th, which is marked as applicant's exhibit A6, in which he talks about that particular tower and that upon analysis, the tower is too far away and also too low in height that it wouldn't work for AT&T's purposes. Mr. Peterson went on to prepare his exhibit A7, which is also dated August 26th. And this is entitled Radio Frequency Design Analysis for the Particular Site Location at 22975 Lewis Georgetown Highway. And this is his summary of the analysis of both the need for coverage and what is being proposed and how the proposed tower at 145 feet would meet the requirements for AT&T. Mr. Peterson would review the surrounding sites, and if you turn to page 3 of that exhibit, that shows AT&T's existing coverage. And right now, you can see kind of towards the center of that exhibit, marked as Salisbury Switch, is the site of the proposed AT&T tower. And that area that's represented here in white is an area where there is inadequate coverage, what he would call unreliable coverage, where a user either traveling along Route 9 through the area or business or resident wouldn't necessarily have optimal coverage in that area. Mr. Peterson would further testify that in particular for AT&T, AT&T utilizes what is known as E911 locational services through an affiliated company called FirstNet, which emergency providers utilize. So from the standpoint of public safety, having a very robust network coverage in that area of gap would be very important for any of the first responders who would utilize FirstNet, the AT&T FirstNet system. And just to close out that exhibit, anything that's depicted here in green would represent reliable, both in-building and in-vehicle coverage. Turning over to the next page of that exhibit, page 4, shows what the coverage would look like in the event that the Salisbury Switch Tower was built by Tower North Development and AT&T was able to place its antennas at the top of that tower. So you can see that that pretty much fills in the gap along Route 9, heading from Georgetown and then heading further to the east, away from town, traveling along Route 9. Mr. Peterson would testify that based upon his analysis that 145 feet would be the minimum height necessary. If you start dropping the antenna height below that height, then what would happen is you'd have areas of less coverage and you wouldn't be able to link up with the network cell site to the east or to the west. And he would further testify that there would be, it's also very important to have some overlap of signal so that there's a proper handoff moving through the cell sites for any of the traveling public utilizing the cell phone. Mr. Peterson would further testify that AT&T is a licensed provider, licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. To operate its network, and there is a mandate under the licensure to provide what he would call reliable coverage to any cell phone user utilizing cell phones within the AT&T network. The summary of licenses are contained, and they're all set at various frequencies and authorize AT&T to operate its network. One of the other requirements under the code is to establish that the facility would comply with FCC regulations on radio wave emissions. And Mr. Peterson did a report, which is marked as applicant's exhibit A9, which is a report dated August 11, 2025, subject electromagnetic exposure analysis. And In doing the required calculations, which are set forth under the FCC regulations, Mr. Peterson was able to determine that in an absolute worst case scenario, that the facility would operate at 2.3% of the accepted level for radio wave emissions. And stated another way, at 2%, that's, you know, roughly, if you had, you know, between 48 and 50 cell sites possibly right at that one location, if that was even feasible, you would still just meet that level threshold for radio wave emissions. But in this instance, obviously, it's only one cell site location with a proposal for six antennas to be placed at the top of the monopole. The other consideration under the code is that the facility not create any adverse radio interference, and Mr. Peterson has authored a letter which is marked as Applicant's Exhibit A10, which is a letter dated August 11, 2025, subject interference analysis. And his conclusion is, again, based upon the fact that AT&T operates at fixed radio frequencies, that there would be no possibility of any harmful interference caused by any other radio technology, whether that be TVs, radios, garage door openers, that sort of thing. If for whatever reason there would be a problem, AT&T monitors each facility 24/7, and if there was any discrepancy, maybe some equipment malfunction or something, the AT&T personnel would be able to detect that and immediately dispatch a crew to take care of that situation so there wouldn't be any further problem with that. Finally, and also to meet code requirements, it needs to be established that the facility complies with any regulations by the Federal Aviation Administration. Mr. Peterson would testify that he has received confirmation that the applicant, AT&T in this instance, has the requirement, it's actually Tower North Development, has the requirement since it's building the tower to make submission to the Federal Aviation Administration, and that submission is known as a Notice of Proposed Construction or Alteration, whereby the FAA ultimately then would determine whether or not the facility meets the requirements for any glide slope heading into an airport. Now, I know that the Delaware Coastal Airport is southwest of this site, about a mile and a half away, and that certainly will be taken into consideration by the FAA, which could require that this facility either be painted, and you've seen some of those structures where they're painted red and white, alternating red or white, to better delineate those for any airplanes that would be flying by. Or require some sort of lighting. Now, in this instance, there was a preliminary analysis done that would indicate that it's out of that glide slope path, so that lighting might not be necessary, but I know that the county code requires lighting at every 50 feet. So one of the requests for variance for relief that was submitted here tonight by the applicant was a request for a variance from that requirement if it's not required by the FAA, but the applicant is also willing to comply with the code. It was just a situation where, you know, I think the applicant's...
I'm gonna jump in here, Mr. Schubert. So the board does not have the authority to grant a variance from that requirement, so it has not been advertised for that, and that's not something this board can grant.
That's fine. We're willing to withdraw, and I was given authority tonight to say if that was not going to be feasible, that we would just move forward and comply with that requirement. Thank you. And that would be, at think that touches upon all the requirements for the RF engineer under the code. So at this point, what I would like to do is call Mr. Peterson. Now, Mr. Peterson, you've been sworn and you've been introduced as a radio frequency engineer and also a professional engineer licensed by the state of Delaware, is that correct?
Correct.
And you were present tonight when I provided a summary of what your testimony would be before this board?
I was.
Is there anything that you would add to that summary of testimony for clarification or modify in any way?
No, there was not.
Would you accept that summary of testimony as your own testimony?
I would.
I'll make Mr. Peterson available to the board if the board has any particular questions.
Any questions?
What is the current property being used for at this time? I see a house on it, but it's commercial, correct?
It's a tenant who lives there. It's a tenant property.
Okay. And where would the placement of the tower be exactly?
It would be at the rear of the property, and I do have an engineer who, and we have the site plans that have been submitted. But if you see on the aerial map, there's an indication of where that would be. And there's a grove of trees at the back of the property, and it would be tucked in a small open space at the rear of that property.
Once this is built, if it is granted, how many trips would you say a month it would take to go back in that property to maintain anything like that?
Typically, a tech would visit the site maybe once a month at most, usually less frequently.
Because, if that is a residence, if there's just people going in and out constantly, I could see how that would be issue for them. Did the tenant is aware of this and is favorable to this?
Yes.
And for you, this meets all like the FAA. I heard what he said, but like just in simple language, this meets all FAA and all the other standards other than what I'm understanding the height of the height.
So it's been submitted to the FAA in the form of notice of proposed construction. The applicant is currently awaiting the FAA determination to see if they require that it be lit or marked. But since the county code requires that it be lit, the point kind of becomes moot unless the FAA for some reason would also require that it be marked, and then it would be the orange and white stripe painting. But As Attorney Schubert mentioned, the preliminary examination revealed that it's unlikely that the FAA would require either, so it would just be the county requirement.
Hearing you say that, I would just not want to approve something that would need to be altered. So what you're saying is where you have it is where it's going to be, meaning your request is where it's going to be.
So the application went in for the height, that's being applied for. If for some reason the FAA determination resulted in the applicant wanting to lower to avoid lighting, then I think that would be a material change to the application. Correct me if I'm wrong. We would probably have to reapply, but I don't foresee that.
Basically, in your opinion, this needs to be this height to go to ping to the other two towers that you referenced to provide full coverage. Otherwise, maybe wouldn't make sense to put that up there.
Right. Yeah. We always want to build to the minimum height required. It's best from a network perspective. We don't want to build too tall where there's overly redundant coverage, but we don't want those antennas to be too short where we don't have that gap filled in. So yeah, the goal is to build to the minimum height required, no taller, but certainly don't want to to make it too short.
Thank you. Any other questions for?
What's the construction timeline for the project?
The next witness is probably better to answer that one. Yeah.
No issues with AP Kroll or the neighboring HVAC? Have you spoken with them at all regarding the cell phone tower?
I'm not aware of any, but I'm probably not the right witness for that either.
Mr. Sharp?
I don't have any questions at this time, but we'll see how the rest of the presentation goes.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next witness that I would call would be Jacob Minardi. He's a licensed engineer with the state of Delaware. He also sealed off on the plans, which have been marked and offered and submitted previously as A12. Now, Mr. Minardi would testify that this property is located within the C1 district, it is identified as parcel number 135-1612 at 22975 Lewis Georgetown Highway. The property is relatively narrow and long. And what would be proposed as shown on sheet Z1 of the plan set is the proposed compound for the telecommunications facility, which would be 65 feet by 65 feet in size. That would be a fenced compound. The code requires a 6-foot high chain link fence, which is what is being proposed. In the center of that would be the proposed monopole structure. Monopole would be 145 feet in height from ground to the top, and at the very top of the monopole would be a lightning rod extension of 4 feet, so that the overall height of the structure would extend to 149 feet if you counted the lightning rod. Setbacks are met for the 145-foot structure. The county code requires the setback of 1/3 the height of the tower. The closest setback would be on the western property line at 48.42 feet, and 1/3 of that would be 48.3. It does comply with the setback requirements. It's a slightly larger setback over onto the western side, and the rear setback goes back to 115 feet to the rear property line. So all the setbacks do comply. The tower itself would be constructed as a single monopole. It would have a concrete foundation that at this point has not yet been designed, but would be designed assuming that the board would see fit to grant the application. There would then be a building permit review process where a soils analysis would have to be undertaken, and soils would be analyzed, and a structure or a foundation would be designed based upon the results of the soil test. The code that applies to all these types of structures, both the foundation and the monopole itself, is what's known as the ANSI, the American National Standards Institute code 222, and it's now, I think, Rev G or H? H, which provides very stringent structural standards that have to be met, and both the foundation and the monopole itself would have to be designed in accordance with those codes. What AT&T then proposes is the placement of antennas at the top of the pole. I believe that AT&T is designing it for 6 antennas or 8 antennas. I think it's a 6-antenna design, but that would be clarified by way of the building permit submission. And the antennas would be panel style antennas. They would be at a center line of 140 feet And then cables would be run down through the center of the monopole out to equipment cabinets that would be located at the base of the monopole on a concrete pad within a compound that would be established for AT&T. The facility itself does not require any water or sewer hookup. It's just electric and fiber hookup. In order to gain access back to the compound, there is an existing driveway that leads up to and just past the house in which the tenant is located, and Tower Development would propose an extension of that driveway that would carry it to the back of where that compound is located. That would be a gravel driveway extension. It would not have to be paved. And of course, the tower company would comply with all the underlying codes, construction codes that would be applicable for the county. The engineers, although not called for under the code, the engineers went ahead and did photo simulation analysis of what the hypothetical installation would look like in the event that it was approved, and that has been marked as applicant's exhibit A14. And essentially, this shows various before and after photographs from various locations around the facility and up and down the Route 9 and by adjoining properties. And Mr. Minardi can talk in a little bit more detail if there's any particular questions in terms of the views that are being offered. I should also mention that the facility, because it is licensed by the FCC as a result of a subsequent order that was issued by the FCC because of hurricane occurrence, each of these facilities has to be reinforced and provide emergency power backup because these provide redundant communications for people and more importantly, emergency responders in such situations. So there is a proposal for a generator. It would be a diesel generator at 20 kilowatts, which is a little bit bigger than a typical household generator would be. It would be a self-contained unit. The diesel fuel would be contained at the base of the generator itself within a double-walled sealed container and would provide emergency backup power for a number of days in the event that electrical service goes down. The casing for the generator would have an attenuation foam that would cut down a lot of the sound. And in terms of operation of the generator, it only really needed to be operated once a week for anywhere from 15 or 20 minutes to exercise the generator itself. That would typically be done during the day, in the morning around 9-10 o'clock. And after that, then there'd be no further requirement for running the generator, except of course in an emergency situation. I should mention that it's another ordinance requirement that the facility be designed for co-location, and this facility is designed for at least two additional co-locators for a total of three antenna arrays on the facility itself. And finally, Mr. Minardi would talk about some of the general standards. Given the location of the facility and the fact that it is a permitted use provided by special use exception, that in this particular instance, where it is located and how it is going to be designed, it would cause no adverse impact on public health, safety, or welfare. It would be suitable for the property, considering environmental conditions, highway access, and of course, there's no sewer water impact with this type of facility. It is commercial in character and therefore would have no adverse impact on the existing character of the immediately surrounding area. There won't be any adverse impact from traffic, as Mr. Peterson had testified and Mr. Minardi would back that up. Typically, these facilities only require infrequent maintenance visits once a month, where a single SUV utility van would show up, maybe stay about 30 minutes, do some diagnostic testing, and that would be it. And there would be no adverse impacts on the neighboring properties in terms of aesthetics, noise, noxious or offensive conditions. And that would be the summation of Mr. Minardi's testimony. Mr. Minardi? Mr. Minardi, you are a licensed engineer with the state of Delaware?
Yes, I am.
And in fact, you sealed the plans that have been presented with this application?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're familiar with the application?
Yes.
And you've heard my summary of your testimony this evening, correct?
Correct.
Is there anything that you would add to that, modify in any way?
No.
And would you adopt that summary of your testimony as your own testimony?
Yes, I would.
I have no further questions. If the board has any questions, Ms. Minardi.
Questions from the board? Other than the commercial neighbors, looking at the photo, there will be some neighbors, residential neighbors. Have they been informed of this, just so they're aware?
Yeah, I think all the neighbors, I think the requirement under the code is 250 feet, and that would be 250 feet from the property lines, not from the tower, so they would have been notified.
One other thing to note also, because you made a statement in regards to the generator exercise time, if this is passed by the board tonight, it does have some issues with what they call ozone days. Which is usually after 5 p.m. is what they like the generators to run, just to be aware of that. So the neighbors need to be aware of that also.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Any further questions from the board? Thank you.
I have no further witnesses at this time, and I would move my exhibits.
Okay. Is there any other questions for? Okay. If you would have a seat. Thank you. Is there anyone present who is in favor of case number 13127? Is there anyone present who is in opposition of case number 13127? There are no further questions from the board. I will close the public hearing and entertain a motion.
And just as I know we've got a couple newer board members, this is a special use exception for a cell tower. There are additional requirements for cell towers that you may have heard Mr. Schubert and his witnesses reference. Under section 115-194.2, they're required to accommodate two other PCS characters. They had to present testimony or evidence that they could not co-locate within another structure within 2 miles. They'll have to have warning lights every 50 feet, no signs and no blinking lights. There's a 6-foot tall fence and a compound requirement as well. But the standard beyond that is that the use does not substantially affect adversely the uses of neighboring and adjacent properties. So I just wanted to let you know of that as you do your delivery.
Sharp, I have a question. Is it necessary that it be valid for a period of time, or is this just?
Nope. You have a right to put limitations on it, but this is not a temporary special use exception.
Okay.
This would be a permanent.
Just wanted to clarify. Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve case number 13127 for Ernest McGee Jr. for the requested special use exemption pending a final written decision based upon the record made during the public hearing, because the proposed use will not substantially affect adversely the uses of the neighboring and adjacent properties.
I second the motion.
I have a motion and a second. Mr. Lovingeth?
Aye.
Mr. Kingery?
Aye.
Dr. Hitchens?
Aye.
And I too. So with a vote of 4-0, case number 13127 has been approved. Good evening.